Hello and welcome to Sound Body, a weekly program of information on health topics and ideas that can help you live life to its fullest. I'm Louise Craig. I stole the title for this week's show from one of the articles we're going to read, Confusion Reigns. It's used to describe the brain confusion a patient is having in one article, but it could also refer to the confusion when doctors have trouble diagnosing a patient. And that is what we're going to read this week, a couple of medical mysteries. Starting with Confusion Reigns, this comes from Discover Magazine and was written by Tony Dager. And that, I don't think I have a time frame on that one. I sensed a commotion rippling across the emergency room. Near the entrance, a man sporting a surgical mask and pajamas was pacing like a tethered ferret. It was 2 a.m., but as a rule, most patients don't wear their PJs to the ER. Something was strange about this one. Heading over, I watched as Claudia, the intake nurse, tried to coax him into the triage chair. He sat for a moment, stood up, then plopped back down. "I need to see your expert," he spat out. "I have to do this quickly."
"Do what, sir?" Claudia asked.
The patient sprang up.
"I can't feel my legs. I can't breathe. Where's your expert?"
His wife walked calmly over from the registration desk.
"John was hospitalized uptown 4 days ago," she told me. "It started then, just like it did tonight, with a headache and confusion."
The spinal tap done uptown had shown a high white blood cell count, indicative of infection, but all the cultures were negative. John had stayed in the ICU and gotten better overnight, a surprise for the uptown staff, who then diagnosed viral meningitis. Meningitis is an inflammation of the meninges, or lining of the brain and spinal cord, usually caused by bacteria or a virus. Bacterial meningitis can be life-threatening, but viral meningitis usually acts more like a passing flu. In line with that diagnosis, they'd sent John home. "Yet just before bed tonight, he had a headache, then woke up babbling again," his wife explained. Now I turned to the patient himself. John looked about 40. He stared at me with a vacant, intense glare that reminded me of someone high on angel dust. The disturbing gaze cinched my first impression. This patient was suffering from altered mental states, the catch-all term for malfunctioning brain. That meant his brain could indeed be under siege by a virus resulting in meningitis. The inflammation and any associated virus causing his confusion could have gone away without treatment. But there was no explanation for why it had returned. What had they missed uptown? I glanced at John's vital signs. Blood pressure, pulse, breathing rate, and temperature were all normal. That was interesting. Viral meningitis usually causes a fever and accelerated heart rate. I turned to the patient again. "What happened tonight, sir?" "It's all right, darling," the wife said soothingly. "This is no worse than last time." "No fever, vomiting, or new medications?" I asked. She shook her head. "I can't stay," John said in a rush. "We have to go."
"First, can I make sure you're okay?" I pleaded. "It really would be better if you stayed," I said in my softest, "please don't make me tie you down" voice.
"See, the doctor's very nice," the wife implored. "How about we get you in a comfortable room?" I offered. "It has a TV." My first-year student, Stacy, materialized. She was there voluntarily, her idea of fun being an overnight in the ER. Together, we shepherded John into a room. We had to move quickly. Altered mental status in an otherwise healthy patient mandates a head CT scan to rule out bleeds and tumors, and a spinal tap to check for meningitis and encephalitis, inflammation of the brain. John, surgical mask still in place, kept popping out of the room.
"What are you going to do?" he demanded. "I need the expert, a neurologist."
His wife laid her hand on his arm. He stopped talking and calmed down.
I told him we would be running tests, but in light of the mega workup he'd gotten uptown, I questioned whether they would show much at all. The safest approach lay straight up the middle. First, rule out immediate life-threatening things, then rethink. Okay, I told Stacy, go in there and get more detail. Fever, headache, nightmares, travel, hearing voices? The weirdest part is how he got better, then bang, bad again. I'm counting on you, kid. For a few minutes, all was calm. Then Stacy came trotting out of the room. Dr. Dager, can he have water and an Advil? He has a headache. Sure, I started saying, then I stopped. Advil? In a vital signs column in Discover magazine published 20 years ago, an infectious disease physician had described the conundrum of a young woman with recurrent meningitis. Hospitalized 4 times in a matter of months, the patient exhibited high fevers, delirium, and a stiff neck, all signs of the life-threatening bacterial septic meningitis. CT scans were normal. Spinal taps revealed high white cell counts in the cerebrospinal fluid, usually a harbinger of severe infection, but bacterial and viral cultures grew nothing. The patient was becoming ill and then abruptly getting better. The 4th time, to general eye rolling, a medical student was tasked with asking the woman for the umpteenth time whether she had taken anything, anything, prior to getting sick. He hit pay dirt. Advil. The patient hadn't considered over-the-counter everyday Advil a medication. It is also sold as Rufin or Motrin, and the chemical moniker is ibuprofen. Ubiquitous as this drug is, until reading the article, I hadn't known that in rare cases it can cause meningitis. Case reports are the lifeblood of diagnosis. The dry, reductionist, what percent have cough and what percent have fever lists in medical texts will put you to sleep. But good stories stick. Doctors trade odd diagnoses like baseball cards. We glean them from journals, TV, and friends, stockpiling them against the next tough diagnosis. Remembering that story even 2 decades later primed me to jump on 1 small clue. Advil! I cried to Stacy. Did he take any tonight before he came in? Yes, when he went to bed 3 hours ago. How about 4 days ago? I didn't ask. Well, I smiled, let's. John was up again, still too bright-eyed and staring, but more there. What are the results? He demanded. I require transportation home. His wife stood by warily. Do you remember taking any medications last time? I asked him. He had a headache that night. The wife tapped her lips. Maybe some Advil? I showed my cards. Look, I began, I can't prove this, but I think all your symptoms are due to the Advil. The best evidence is whether you took some before each episode. The wife's face lit up. Yes, he definitely took some the first time. Could that really be it? It's poorly understood, I said. It's probably a hypersensitivity immune reaction. The ibuprofen may bind to specific tissues, like the meninges that line the brain, and set off an antibody attack. Most reported cases are in patients with immune disorders like lupus, but some have been in healthy people. It can happen with other anti-inflammatory drugs like Aleve. The hallmark, besides the confusion and meningeal irritation, is that you get better quickly off the Advil. I turned to Stacy and smiled. Nice work, Sherlock. She blushed. Thanks. To John, I said, I'm not going to scan or tap you. I crossed my arms. I think you're okay. You sure? He asked. I had an improving patient, a solid story, a negative recent workup, and a very intelligent and attentive spouse. I felt it was safe to release him. Go home, I ventured. Get some sleep and I'll call you later this morning. Have your neurologists recheck everything this afternoon. What's non-negotiable is this. You come back lickety-split if anything feels worse. Still dubious, John asked, can I take off the mask? Yes, dear, please, his wife sighed. 8 hours later, we spoke. I'm better, John ventured, still hesitant. The legs are a bit tingly, but I can walk and the headache's gone. A week later, his wife phoned to tell me a neurologist had decided John had a form of temporal lobe seizure. These can cause bizarre behavior, but none of the muscle clenching or loss of consciousness seen in regular grand mal seizures. He started John on Keppra, she recounted, referring to a potent anticonvulsant, but it's making him very drowsy. John's course after discharge was as I had predicted, give or take a few vague symptoms. And diagnosis of a seizure relies heavily on patient history. There is no test that proves it. While the neurologist was trying his best to make a diagnosis based on vague, nonspecific symptoms, I was sure I had it right. Look, I told the wife, every specialty has its default diagnosis. Seizures can do just about anything, but they don't cause white cells in spinal taps. I truly think John is okay. It boils down to so little data, so many competing hypotheses. She fell silent, then said, I'm taking him off the Keppra. A month later, he was doing fine. No more than 100 cases of ibuprofen-induced meningitis have been reported in the literature. But you have to wonder, given that ibuprofen is practically in the drinking water, how many more mistaken cases of viral meningitis are out there? And we move on to the cause of this man's suffering was hiding in plain sight. This was written by Sandra G. Boodman for The Washington Post of January 25th, 2020. Their December 2017 meeting was winding down when Albuquerque neurologist David R. Smith III decided to say something. His lawyer, Sid Lopez, looked very ill, much worse than he had a few months earlier. His skin had the grayish pallor common to cancer patients. He had dark circles under his eyes and had lost so much weight that his cheeks were sunken. What, Smith gently inquired, was wrong? Lopez replied that he had recently returned from California, where he had undergone a painful, expensive procedure to repair a possible spinal fluid leak. It was, he told Smith, the latest chapter in his seven-year quest to diagnose the illness that had made his life a misery. Lopez had consulted multiple specialists at some of the nation's most respected hospitals, resulting in tests and scans too numerous to count. His stepfather and father-in-law, both physicians, were baffled. One gastroenterologist even suggested to Lopez that his wife, a nurse, might be poisoning him. His gallbladder had been removed, an unnecessary operation that caused permanent complications, and the first of three spinal procedures had left him feeling more wretched than ever. Smith asked a few questions, then offered to review Lopez's medical records. The lawyer initially refused, then relented after Smith pressed him. It was, he says, one of the best decisions he ever made. Smith's eagle-eyed examination spotted a critical clue that had been overlooked for years, culminating in a diagnosis that the 15 physicians who treated Lopez apparently never considered. At first, I didn't believe David's theory, recalled Lopez, now 44. I'd been burned a lot of times. In December 2010, Lopez was visiting an airplane hangar with his employer, who owned a Cessna. While walking around the plane, Lopez, blinded by the glare of the late afternoon sun, smacked forehead first, hard, into the low slung wing. I fell to the ground but didn't black out, he remembered. Lopez got to his feet and insisted he was fine. I was more embarrassed than anything. A week later, he began feeling hungover. Returning from his daily 5-mile run, Lopez started trembling and felt so weak he had to lie on the bathroom floor. His wife brought him a glass of orange juice. Within minutes, he seemed to have recovered. But a few weeks afterward, Lopez suddenly became dizzy and extremely nauseated while drinking a beer. He stopped drinking alcohol, but the hungover feeling persisted, accompanied by a headache, shakiness, vomiting, and diarrhea. His primary care doctor at the time, Lopez said, was dismissive, telling him he was anxious and working too hard. It was an explanation he would hear from other doctors. During the next 6 months, Lopez consulted an ear, nose, and throat specialist in Albuquerque who ruled out labyrinthitis, an infection of the inner ear that causes vertigo and nausea. An ENT expert in Los Angeles suggested he might have chronic fatigue syndrome. At the recommendation of his internist stepfather, Lopez underwent a brain MRI. A neurologist told Lopez he had an acoustic neuroma, a benign brain tumor, then abruptly changed her mind and said the scan showed nothing. Visits to gastroenterologists led nowhere. One New Mexico specialist, for reasons that remain inexplicable, suggested that Lopez's wife might be intentionally poisoning him, but failed to order toxicology tests. Lopez remembers feeling flabbergasted by the speculation. His wife, Lorena, had been unfailingly supportive in every possible way. His stepfather, whom Lopez called my medical rock, was aghast. That is absurd, Lopez remembers him saying. I can't believe these people. In 2014, a third gastroenterologist recommended removal of Lopez's gallbladder, citing his 45-pound weight loss coupled with the results of a scan that seemed to indicate biliary dyskinesia, a disorder in which bile drainage is impaired. The operation was a failure and left him feeling sicker. A fourth gastroenterologist diagnosed post-cholecystectomy syndrome, a complication of gallbladder surgery that causes severe nausea and diarrhea. She referred him to a prominent out-of-state medical center for a comprehensive GI workup. Lopez spent a week there in 2015. Doctors weren't sure what was wrong, but told him he appeared to be unusually sensitive to certain foods. Lopez noted that although he craved salt, he became violently ill after eating salty foods such as popcorn. Doctors prescribed a diet sometimes recommended for irritable bowel syndrome, as well as a drug to slow digestion. Neither helped. In 2016, Lopez decided to stop seeing doctors for a while. He had exhausted every option he could think of. Too sick to attend his children's school events or eat dinner with his family most nights, he routinely came home from work and fell into bed. At times, I thought I was going to have to close my practice, he recalled. Losing my work would have been the final nail in the coffin. In July 2017, a seemingly promising new explanation emerged after Lopez and his wife traveled to a major teaching hospital in California. Several tests, including a spinal MRI, showed a possible chronic leak of cerebrospinal fluid from the dura, the outer membrane that surrounds the brain and spinal cord. Experts told Lopez they believed the leaks were the result of his 2010 collision with the Cessna, but couldn't pinpoint their location. They recommended a series of epidural blood patches in which a small amount of blood is injected into the epidural space in the spine to plug the leak. Days after the October procedure, Lopez said he vividly remembers recovering in a hotel room, lying flat on my back and my wife feeding me cereal. He was told to temporarily boost his consumption of caffeine and salt to increase the production of spinal fluid. For weeks afterward, he was violently ill. I got very depressed, Lopez recalled. During an emotional conversation with his wife, he confided that while he never felt suicidal, he wasn't sure how he could continue living in his current condition. The meeting with Smith occurred a few weeks later. As he paged through Lopez's records, Smith was struck by the absence of a positional headache, pain that improves when lying flat. It is one of the most common symptoms of a spinal fluid leak, and when he looked at the MRI, the neurologist did not see a leak. Lopez told Smith, as he had the doctors he had seen, that his symptoms started after he hit his head. He said he was fine until then, Smith said. To me, it seemed logical to start there. Lopez mentioned that he had recently told his internist that he was getting up six or more times each night to urinate. Smith suspected the cause might not be his prostate, the most common origin of such a problem, but rather dehydration, which can result from an electrolyte problem. Reviewing his lab tests, Smith spotted a slightly but persistently elevated sodium count in the years after the accident, but not before. He calculated Lopez's serum osmolality, which measures the concentration of sodium ions and other substances in the blood. The specialized test is sometimes ordered to check for an electrolyte imbalance, but had never been ordered. Smith's calculations showed that it, too, was elevated. Smith suspected that the blow to Lopez's head might have damaged his pituitary, the pea-sized gland at the base of the brain, which serves as the body's metabolic control center. A traumatic brain injury can cause hypopituitarism, a condition in which a hormone deficiency impairs normal function. One of the hormones released by the pituitary is antidiuretic hormone, ADH, which regulates fluid balance. The neurologist theorized that Lopez's damaged pituitary had caused central diabetes insipidus, a rare disorder in which the kidneys remove too much fluid. The condition is unrelated to the far more common diabetes mellitus, which involves blood sugar. Lopez was initially skeptical. "I remember feeling kind of irritated when David said I didn't have a CSF leak and shouldn't get another patch," he recalled. "I'd already pursued a lot of dead ends." But Lopez was desperate. "I remember thinking, I don't even care if I get well, I just want an answer." Smith urged Lopez to ask his primary care doctor to order osmolality and urine tests. Lopez said his new internist balked, telling him, "You don't have diabetes insipidus, it's so rare." After Lopez insisted, the internist ordered the tests, followed by a second round. All were abnormal, but the doctor remained unconvinced. Lopez pushed for a referral to an endocrinologist. He too was skeptical, but ordered additional tests that yielded the same result, along with a scan that ruled out a pituitary tumor. Now there could be no doubt. Smith's meticulous analysis had led to the diagnosis of diabetes insipidus that essentially had been hiding in plain sight. Lopez began taking a form of vasopressin, the replacement hormone he will need for the rest of his life. Slowly but steadily, he began to improve. His nighttime urination stopped once he started taking the medication. "I feel 80 to 90% better," Lopez said recently. He carefully monitors his salt intake to prevent sodium overload, must avoid becoming overheated, he no longer runs, and cannot consume alcohol or caffeine, which are too dehydrating. He also takes expensive medication to treat the consequences of his unnecessary gallbladder surgery. Lopez is trying to make up for the years he lost with his children, who are now 5, 12, and 14. He deeply regrets that his stepfather, who he said was consumed by trying to help him, did not live to see the outcome. He died in 2015. Lopez thinks his work as a malpractice lawyer actually set me back. "There were too many chefs in the kitchen," he said. "I think the fact that I had so many connections, it put me on the wrong course. I also think that but for me doing this work, I would never have met the person who diagnosed it," he added. He said he worries about others who are suffering and lack support or resources. "I represent people like that all the time," he added. Smith, who's been in practice for 18 years, has a different perspective. "I felt there was a lot of tunnel vision," he said, adding that he believes time constraints may have played a role. "There are a lot of practices that run like an assembly line." In the neurologist's view, the most glaring error may have been the failure to take a complete and careful history, the cornerstone of the diagnostic process, and to listen carefully to what Lopez was reporting. Smith said he remains surprised by the resistance that Lopez, a medically knowledgeable patient, encountered when he pursued a possible diagnosis of diabetes insipidus. "Some arrogant physicians are offended by an outside doctor's suggestion," Smith said. "It wounds egos." Now, I love reading medical mysteries, but they do tend to be long and make it hard to fit into the half-hour format, which means we have some extra time. I have been collecting podcasts about health and wellness and hope that you might be interested in these as well as Sound Body. And these first ones come from Prevention Magazine of August 8th, 2019. Science V's, that's a V as in Victor. If you've ever wondered whether essential oils can really cure your migraines or if the 7-minute workout is actually effective, then Gimlet Media's spunky Science V's is for you. In each episode, host Wendy Zuckerman tackles a hot topic and breaks it down, providing science-based facts so you can form an educated opinion. Another podcast is the Food Psych Podcast, hosted by Christy Harrison, RD, MPH, CDN, aims to break down women's disordered relationships with food, body image, size acceptance, and more. She opens up about her own journey with disordered eating and offers tips to help others improve their relationships with food and body image. Harrison also calls out the fad diet and weight loss gimmicks that fuel the diet culture in America. Another podcast, Optimal Health Daily. The overwhelming amount of health and wellness content out there these days can be hard to sift through. If you'd like your health news a little more curated, check out Optimal Health Daily, which scours the web for the best blog content, then reads it with author permission. They address the latest health trends and your most pressing questions on topics like intermittent fasting, flu vaccinations, flossing, and more. And Modern Love. While not a traditional health and fitness podcast, the New York Times column Modern Love is an excellent choice for those interested in mental health and the complexities of interpersonal relationships. And I can vouch for Modern Love. It is now also a TV show, and it is really terrific. Thank you for tuning in to Sound Body today. Please stay well and come back next week for more healthy living ideas. This has been Sound Body, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. I'm Louise Craig, and I hope you'll join me again next week for more health updates and information for healthy living. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, wxxi.org.